There was one item that we didn't quite finish last time, and that had to do with Ruth chapter 4, verses 1 to 10. You were asked to compare these verses with the provisions of Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 to 10, and to take note of the difference and consider what possibly might account for the difference. Okay, what did you notice in that comparison? Who wants to tell us the fruits of their cogitation? Mike?
One different kind of spread out the sacrifice.
Okay. At least it doesn't explicitly say so, yeah. Anything else that's interesting there? Yes.
Well, in the Deuteronomy, it talks, the woman was supposed to go, I think, to the other. And in this case, Moab took the responsibility to win the
head. Mm-hmm. Did you notice that there's that distinction as well? That Boaz runs into the individual in question in a situation where the elders of the city, or I should say, not say city, Bethlehem never was a city until the modern period, that town or village and were present, and he seizes that opportunity to conduct this legal bit of business here, and he's the one that carries it on totally. Anything else? Jeff?
The brother didn't seem to be under obligation to do it, but Boaz quite easily said to do it next in line, and the brother just said he didn't want to do it.
Brother.
Well, it says in verse 3 that our brother Elimelech.
Our brother Abimelech. Who was Abimelech?
Elimelech.
Sorry, Elimelech. Or you throw me off because in Hebrew the Elimelech. Okay, okay, go ahead. Anyway, who? Where are you familiar with the book of Ruth? The name of Elimelech or Elimelech begins in the first chapter, and that tells you who he is. Who is he?
Naomi's son.
Ah. Now, is he Boaz's brother? From what you know of the book, is Elimelech the brother of Boaz? That would make him the brother-in-law of Naomi, right? Does she allude to him in that connection? Yeah. Anywhere in the book? Who knows?
Well, verse 3.
I don't know all the verses in chapter by heart, sorry. I've got to look. Verse 4, chapter 3. Yes, okay. Yes, but so this kinsman is also a brother? So Boaz and this kinsman and Elimelech are all brothers. Okay. What's your error?
They're not.
Good. That reminds me of a class I took as a student in Roman history, and the professor, who was quite a knowledgeable individual, was showing slides of a trip to various sites of antiquity, and he was explaining each in incredible detail, dates and places and methods of construction and rulers that were involved with each place and so on. And finally he came to the slide, and there was this deathly silence from the back of the room. And finally, everybody turned around to look at him, and he wasn't saying anything, so one of the students ventured a question. He said, "Dr. McCracken, what is that?" And he looked at it, and he looked at it over his glasses and under his glasses and through his glasses, and he says, "Well, it's a castle on an island," which we all could see. It's like your admission that he wasn't. But the thing is this, do you learn from the fact that since he is not a brother and yet the text seems to say so, what should we learn?
He did the same for
Well, can't we bring it a bit closer? Or you just use brother that loosely? Now, I don't think they would use it quite that loosely. That he's a kinsman. But that's all it means. And the term brother, you see, is used loosely in the same way the term father is used loosely. It depends on context. For instance, anyone who was an Israelite of either the northern or the southern house could refer to our father Abraham in literal truth, though it's way, way, way back. But there are other scriptures where a person refers to a father, and it's not a father, it's a grandfather, you know, or maybe more removed. It's the same thing in the genealogies where it says so-and-so begat so-and-so. It doesn't mean he literally produced directly of his own loins that individual. Because we have evidence, and especially I think we've already made reference to this in Matthew's account of the genealogy of Christ. If you turn there for a second, which I hope you know is in Matthew chapter 1. For example, verse 11 is one I could seize upon very quickly. Josiah begat Jeconiah. Now that's an impossibility because we know that Josiah begat the individual who was known as Jehoiakim, and Jehoiakim begat Jeconiah or Jehoiachin. So you've got a grandfather-grandson relationship, but it just says begat. There's nothing wrong with that. Now we would say that's an inaccuracy because of our standards of the way we write things and refer to things. But in those days, people didn't use such narrow definitions. It was perfectly acceptable. It's not an attempt to deceive or mislead. It's just within the common usage of that day, that's an acceptable thing. As I mentioned that before, that there are four kings of Judah that are omitted from that genealogy. Four kings of Judah. That's one of them. Jehoiakim doesn't appear. And there are three others as well that don't appear. If you're curious, you can go back, make a list of the ones that do appear from Solomon to Jehoiachin, or Jeconiah, as it says there, and then go back in your Bible and check your orders, and you'll find the other three kings that don't appear. Now, don't ask me why Matthew left them out, those specifically, rather than some others. I don't know. But, you know, it didn't change Christ's genealogy. It still was abundantly proved that he came from that particular line. At least Mary did. I mean, Joseph did. Okay. So, as I said, this term brother, our brother Elimelech, just means our kinsman. Now, you started out to make a point before I deflected you, so I forgot what the point was. Oh, that why didn't he do it? Okay, let's get back to that point. Why is it that these people who are more distantly related or even involved in the situation? All right, Ruth's father-in-law is dead. Elimelech is dead because Naomi is a widow. Her husband is dead. Why didn't her husband's brother do it? If you know the story of the book of Ruth, you can answer the question. If you don't know the story of the book of Ruth, you should read it sometime. It was normally read every Pentecost, so maybe you can set yourself the goal. You have to wait that long of reading it next Pentecost. And being very biblical. But, you know, why didn't her brother-in-law do so? Don?
They were also dead.
Yeah, there's only one other brother-in-law who had married to her sister-in-law, Ophrah. Remember, the two of them were willing to follow Naomi, and Naomi says, no, go back to your father's houses and find new husbands. And they said, you know, even if I were to marry now and have a child, it would be years before they could, you know, be a levir to you, to use the technical term. So, and you'd be so old by then, you know, it'd be ridiculous for me to wait on the off chance I should produce a child, which is very unlikely because I'm so old, you see. So that was the only other child she had. Both of her sons died. There was no one left in the immediate family. So you're dealing with distant relationships. Now, it's interesting, the kinsman is never named. And there's a Jewish tradition, the reason why he's never named is because he refused to do what Boaz was willing to do, simply because Ruth was a Moabitess. And he didn't want to pollute his line with foreign blood. And as a consequence, he excluded himself from being in the ancestry of Jesus Christ because he didn't want to pollute his line with foreign blood. Because Ruth was perfectly acceptable, though a Moabitess, because she was converted to the faith of Israel. She made that intent very clear to Naomi when she said, not only wherever you go, you will go, I will go, but your people shall be my people, which is very admirable. But she was willing to go the whole way when she said, your God shall be my God. I think as an element of the depth of her devotion, I might pause to comment on, she didn't even stop at that point. But she says, where you die and are buried, there also shall I be buried. That nothing shall separate us from now on, not even death will be buried in the same place. That's quite a measure of her devotion. It's a beautiful phrase, and it stands, I think, as a landmark of the kind of relationship, of course, that ideally a wife should have for her husband, at least as being willing to go wherever he goes. Sometimes women have to call a limit to that. I know Mrs. Halford went with her husband to the feast in Nigeria. And after that trip, she said to him, whither thou goest, send me a postcard. You haven't been to the feast in Nigeria, you don't understand that. But they had their problems. Not the people. The people were lovely, as God's people always are. But the country and the way it's run left a lot to be desired, especially on leaving at the airport. They found out that having a confirmed reservation and boarding pass simply meant you had a right to run for the plane and hope to find a seat, since there were twice as many boarding passes as there were seats. And that just because it said in the schedule a plane was going to take off on a certain day, it meant it might. It has been known to. Not in Nigeria, but in another country in Central Africa. Unfortunately, one of our ministers was traveling and had a confirmed reservation on a particular flight and found out to his dismay that the president of the country had taken off in the plane. It was the only plane that was available, and he had just decided to go off somewhere, and so they canceled the flight. So these things do happen. Now, I don't know if that story is true about Mrs. Halford or not. You can ask Mr. Halford or Mrs. Halford. Anyway, how did we get into that? whither thou goest. Okay. Now, we've got a number of differences. How do we account for these differences? How do we account for these? Deadly silence. It's in the text. At least a strong hint as to what might account for the difference. There might be another explanation as well, but... Yes. I keep forgetting your name.
Flavia.
That's right. You're the one I kept trying to call by your Latin name. Okay. Okay, so we're dealing with a piece of land. We're not dealing primarily just with a levirate situation alone. It's a complication. You've got land involved here. The redemption of a piece of land. Now, it is supposed to be the near kinsman, the nearest kinsman is supposed to redeem the land. Now, it's not just the land. There is a redemption of Ruth also, you see. Because if you go back into chapter 3, after Ruth, following the instructions of her mother-in-law, has lain down at his feet and taken part of his garment to cover herself, thereby symbolically showing she wanted to be his wife. So many things in those days was done by actions without words. We've lost that, not totally in our culture. We still say things with actions. I mean, everybody knows what this means. You know, we have a few, or in baseball anyway, we know what that means, or this means, everybody, I think. So, you know, we still do certain things we read from actions. But they had a lot more. It seems like it was a much more colorful culture. But this spoke to him, and unfortunately the English text does not preserve the full strength of the Hebrew, but it says here in verse 12, now it is true that I am your near kinsman, however there is a kinsman who is nearer than I. tarry this night, and it shall be in the morning, that if he will perform to you the part of a kinsman, well, let him do a kinsman's part. But if he will not do the part of a kinsman to you, now my English translation says, then I will do the part of a kinsman to you. Now, does somebody have a stronger English rendition? What do you have? Yeah, that's still not the strength that's in the original Hebrew. No one else has another alternate translation. Okay, I thought it might have come out in one of these newer translations that some of you are using. But it literally, the word is right there in the Hebrew. I don't know why it's omitted in the English text. It's not like it's a combination of words or a word that can be interpreted various ways. It's just left out. Then I will be pleased, or I will be most happy to do the part of a kinsman to you. I think it shows his earnestness in that. But so we have both a piece of land and Ruth that have to be redeemed. And it is possible, because it's more than just the normal kind of leverage situation, that therefore it's something to be handled between the men themselves, because land is involved. That might be one explanation. And since Ruth is not present, there's no opportunity for her to perform the ceremony of spitting in the face. There is also the possibility that the way this was carried out changed. We have here a reflection of a change in the operation of the law through circumstance. Remember, we're dealing with a living law, and even though it's a commandment that they're observing, these things do change. Because as something which is developed in the second semester class, we don't have time to do it in this semester class, is that when we think about the oral law, it is ridiculous to assume it was all an invention of the Pharisees. That oral law began with Moses, and we have scriptural proof of that. And it continued throughout the Old Testament period, and we find in certain places individuals making oral law, which then has the same force and binding nature as the written law. It appears in several of the biblical books. Sometimes we see the process taking place. We have testimony of the actual process at the time the new law was made. In other places, we don't see the process, we just see the end result. And this is something that's explored in connection with the Pharisees' opinions about law in the second semester. Now, this then might be another example of changes through oral tradition as to how to carry it out. So either one or both might be involved in this situation. But both the land and Ruth are redeemed. And notice the kinsman who is not named says he doesn't want to do it lest he mar his inheritance. And it means the purity of his line. And he was overly concerned about that. And maybe that's why the book itself specifically ends showing, even in the Old Testament time, who came of that union. Somebody, you know, very, very distinguished, probably one of the most distinguished people in the whole history of Israel, David, came of that union. And this person might have been the individual who had that honor to be in the genealogy and didn't. So it's interesting, the tradition deliberately seems to have excluded his name. Okay, that was the thing we hadn't covered, was the incident there with Ruth. Now, with what I wanted to do today is to talk about the legal system in the period we're talking about, the time of the judges, and how it operated. We already touched on the point that the primary people involved in the administration of justice were the local elders, those who were village or town or city elders. We find provision for this in Deuteronomy chapter 1, beginning in verse 10. Deuteronomy chapter 1, beginning in verse 10. It says, "The Eternal your God has multiplied you, and behold, you are this day as the stars of heaven for multitude." In verse 12, we have a parenthetical statement in verse 11. Continue on in verse 12. "How can I myself alone bear your cumbrance and your burden and your strife? Take you wise men and understanding and known among your tribes, and I will make them rulers over you. And you answered me and said, the thing which you have spoken is good for us to do. So I took the chief of your tribes, wise men and known, and made them heads over you, captains over thousands, and captains over hundreds, and captains over fifties, and captains over tens, and officers among your tribes. And I charged your judges at that time, saying, hear the causes between your brethren, and judge righteously between every man and his brother and the stranger that is with him. Now, it is interesting, just parenthetically, the next statement, that you shall not respect persons in judgment, but you shall hear the small as well as the great. You shall not be afraid of the face of man, for the judgment is God's. Now, it's interesting that elsewhere it mentions that God was concerned about not only the judge showing partiality to the important person or the wealthy person, which is what you would expect, but God also says the opposite. Don't give special consideration to a man because he's poor, which unfortunately has crept in large measure in our society. You know, people, juries especially, saying, oh, they don't have really a case, maybe, but look at this poor person. You know, we've got to do something. You know, so we've got to find something in their favor, you know. And God says specifically, you don't do that. You judge a case on its merits regardless of the condition of the plaintiff and the defendant. So we've lost that aspect of true judgment. Another chapter where we have these elders mentioned again is Deuteronomy 19, in verses 11 and 12. Any man hate his neighbor. Any man hate his neighbor and lie in wait for him and rise up against him and smite him mortally that he dies and flees into one of these cities. It's talking now about the cities of refuge. Then the elders of his city shall send and fetch him and deliver him into the hand of the avenger of blood that he die. See, it's the job of the elders to send qualified individuals to the city of refuge and drag that man back and turn him over to the avenger of blood. You see, there's again the role of the elders. Chapter 21, verse 18. If a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, which will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and that when they have chastened him will not hearken to them, then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him and bring him out to the elders of his city, to the gate of his place, because that was where the elders would meet. And they shall say to the elders of the city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious, he will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. And all the men of his city shall stone him with stones that he die. That was following the judgment, of course, of the elders. We also find, of course, the elders being involved. We just took a look at the case of Ruth's situation. That Boaz goes in the city gate and finds the kinsmen and says, you know, the elders are here, let's take the case to them. Now, this is the way most justice was to be administered, whether it was a matter of civil matters, like inheritance, marriage status, or criminal matters. They were the ones primarily responsible. Now, what happened if the city or village elders or town elders found they didn't know what to do with a particular case? They lacked enough experience to know exactly what would be a righteous judgment. These things do happen. They even happen, believe it or not, in God's church. In situations involving where the minister, the local minister, finds himself hard put to know what would represent God's judgment in the matter. And he does just what the local elders used to do back in ancient days. You take the case to a higher authority, more knowledgeable one. Deuteronomy chapter 17 gives this provision. Deuteronomy 17, verse 8. If there arise a matter too hard for you in judgment, between blood and blood, between plea and plea, which is simply civil matters, plea and plea, between stroke and stroke, being matters of controversy within your gates, then you shall arise and get you up into the place which the Eternal your God shall choose, and shall come to the Levitical priests, as it should be translated, not the priests, the Levites, meaning two groups, but the Levitical priests, and unto the judge that shall be in those days, and inquire, and they shall show you the sentence of judgment. You shall do according to the sentence which they of that place which the Eternal shall choose shall show you. And you shall observe to do according to all they inform you, according to the sentence of the law which they shall teach you. In other words, they don't just make the decision, but they explain the basis on which the decision was reached. That's what's involved in teaching the elders, so that if a similar situation comes up again, they don't have to come back again. They now know the principle to apply and how to apply it, so they can do it now at home. That's the whole purpose of them being instructed, as it says here in verse 11. According to the sentence of the law which they shall teach you, and according to the judgment which they shall tell you. You see, they're two separate things. It's not a case of the judge and the Levitical priest saying, this is our decision. That doesn't have to be taught. It just has to be listened to and obeyed. But they are taught, in other words, the sentence, how they arrived at that particular judgment, so they can carry on thereafter. You shall not decline from the sentence which I shall show you to the right nor to the left. You shall carry it out the same way they showed you how to do it, you see. Now, this is not to be construed as an appeals court system. What's the difference between this and an appeals court system? Dan?
In an appeals court, the guilty person takes the plea.
Okay, you can say guilty because that's right. There has been a verdict. A judge has rendered his decision, or a jury has rendered their decision. But one of the two parties hasn't liked the decision, and they want another court to rehear the case and possibly reverse the decision. That's not what we've got operative here. What we have operative is a situation where the judges look at the case and they say, we don't know how to decide it. This is too complicated for us. We don't know which principle to apply or how to apply the principle and be righteous. We need somebody with more experience and knowledge. And so they, in other words, they're refusing to make any decision at all. And they're asking the case to be heard and decision rendered by a higher competent authority. There's no such thing as them reaching a judgment and then somebody appealing it to a higher court. So that we have a distinction here. Now, this is the system God set in motion because he holds, or held, I should say, the priest primarily responsible for the knowledge of his law and the teaching of it and the interpretation of it. This is the point which is brought out in, I believe it's Malachi, chapter 2, where in this first chapter and the second chapter, the priests come in for a lot of criticism from Malachi. Not that Malachi himself is the source. God is the source of the criticism. Malachi is simply, as his name means, the messenger. But now it gets down into more specifics in Malachi chapter 2, where it talks about, you know, it's being addressed to the priests. And it's, if we come down here to verse 6, it says, the law of truth was in his mouth, and iniquity was not found in his lips. He's talking about, of course, with Levi. He walked with me, and not Levi specifically, he means, you know, the house of Levi, especially beginning with Aaron. He walked with me in peace and equity and did turn many away from iniquity. For the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they, meaning the people, should seek the law at his mouth. It was the priest's responsibility to be the experts on the law and how to apply it. You find other scriptures dealing with this particular point. Especially Ezekiel 44, verse 23. This is a prophecy for the time yet future, even for us. Ezekiel 44, verse talking about the fact the priesthood is going to be purified again in the future. Beginning in verse 23. They shall teach my people the difference between the holy and the profane, and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean. And in controversy, they shall stand in judgment, and they shall judge it according to my judgments. Not that they have to hear every case any more than Moses had to hear every case. Moses chose wise, and we would use the term, understanding people who were willing to be guided by God's laws, and therefore let them make the bulk of the decisions, reserving, in his case, the most complicated matters, which they felt they didn't understand. Same thing will be true in the case of these priests. You have another reference here in Jeremiah chapter 2 to the role of the priests in the legal system. This is again a rebuke of them. God is speaking through Jeremiah in chapter 2. And if we back up here into verse 7, we catch the drift. I brought you into a plentiful country to eat the fruit thereof and the goodness thereof, but when you entered, you defiled my land and made my heritage an abomination. The priest said not, where is the Eternal? And they that handle the law knew me not. In other words, they presume to judge according to their own understanding instead of according to the understanding that God gave through his law. So that was a mistake. Now, I'd like to end this particular session by making a general comparison between penal laws in the Old Testament period and today under four headings. Comparison between penal laws in the Old Testament and today under these four headings. The first is the matter of retribution. If you mention today to legal scholars and judges that one of the purposes of a penal law is to make the criminal pay for his crime, most will say, that's wrong. That should not be a purpose of the law. The principle of retribution today is questioned as whether it's worthy of an enlightened society. Now, they have other reasons why a person should be punished, but not that it should be seen specifically as retribution. This is something that in the wisdom of our great legal minds is questionable. God says something very different. He says there's a penalty for sin. And man is responsible for his actions. If you study Exodus 21 and Exodus 22 and look at the provisions you will find there, it's quite apparent what God's mind is in this matter. As far as retribution is concerned, he does not feel it is unjust to exact retribution for crimes. For example, what was a common form of retribution under the laws as given to Israel by God? Larry? Fourfold. That's retribution. You just don't restore, you also pay back over, you see. That's just one such instance. The second principle that I'd like to compare is the matter of deterrence. The idea that the law was meant to serve as a deterrent. There's a very frequent phrase there. What is that phrase that appears often in the scripture? So that others will hear and fear, you see. And I think that was indeed true then. It is the opinion of legal minds that deterrence doesn't operate, that there is no deterrent force to the law. One noted jurist wrote, "It may be doubted if one murderer stayed his hand or one burglar stayed away from an inviting home simply because he knew if he was caught, he would be sent to prison or worse." And so, as I say, there's this feeling that there is no such thing as a deterrence factor. There's a doubt that there is any virtue of thinking of the law as operating in that fashion. And yet God says explicitly that it would work that way. He said, if you do this as I've commanded, they will hear and fear. I'll give you some scriptures. Deuteronomy 13, verse 11. Deuteronomy 17, verse 13. Deuteronomy 19, verse 20. And Deuteronomy 21, verse 21. This principle of hearing and fearing. Now, why is it that God said they would hear and fear, and yet great legal minds doubt whether that really works? Well, you see, the way we carry out our punishments is very different. What was some of the aspects of punishment in ancient Israel that would have had this deterrent effect that we don't have today, especially, Dan? Yeah, people saw it. You see, it was open punishment. Open punishment. Another aspect of it, which is very important, everybody recognizes the importance of this in terms of deterrence. Whether you're dealing simply with child rearing, which of course is a much minor type of thing, or you're dealing with major infractions against the law of a society, something must happen, otherwise you've lost your power of deterrence. Arthur? Swift. You didn't have this extensive delay before the case is even heard. How long has the night stalker been in, the accused, excuse me, night stalker, that are watching us be sued for slander, been in custody? When was he arrested? It was late August. He has still not had his preliminary hearing yet, let alone his trial. And this is end of October. And by the time he is sentenced and the appeals are finished with, who knows when this thing will be settled? This is something that, because we are so concerned about rights, and I'm saying it's not wrong that we should be concerned about rights, I'm very grateful we live in a country where there is protection for rights, but it seems we've carried it to such an extreme that we've lost something vital from the point of view of the protection of society. Swift judgment. Now, they were able to do it because they had sufficient numbers of courts, and they didn't have any appeal system. It was just a rare case that was so complicated that had to be referred to a higher court, and even that could be done relatively quickly. Another thing that made the deterrent work then is the punishments were equally applied. It made no difference if you were a rich landowner or a poor peasant. There was one penalty for the same infraction. Too often that doesn't work today. I was very gratified to read the end of a case that took place somewhere in Illinois, I think it was Chicago, not to demean Chicago, but it was a case of a judge who had been found guilty of taking bribes in order to either give light sentences or find grounds for overturning verdicts and so on. And his lawyers were appealing for mercy in his case on the grounds that, you know, he was an honorable man, he was tempted, and unfortunately, because of weakness and pressures in his both society and his own family environment, gave way to these temptations and took some bribes. And the judge hearing the case said, no way am I going to buy that as a defense. We have, in this case, a clear record of a pattern, a persistent pattern of bribe-taking, not one or two instances where he weakened. This is a man who set out deliberately to make money on the side and pervert the ends of justice, and he treated him just the way he would have treated anybody else, you know, who is guilty of taking bribes, and took no recognition of the fact that he had been a judge. Now, that's the way it should be, but it made the papers. for the simple reason because it was so unusual that somebody in influence was not given special consideration by a court for a change. This is not always true in our society, unfortunately. Another aspect that led to deterrence is they had a... what were the major punishments as provided for in Scripture? There were basically three categories of punishments provided for in practically all those laws that you wade through. You can classify almost all the punishments into one of three categories. Mr. Friesen. Financial loss, which might really hurt. Yes, what else? Yeah. Physical punishment or death, of course, was a, we can maybe lump them together. And financial, and the third one was what? Well, no, slavery. I mean, it doesn't matter who inflicts the death penalty. So, you know, these things really hurt. And people that saw that penalty swiftly applied, hard on the heels of the crime and its discovery, it had more force. It had more force. Sometimes one wonders. I know the Secretary of the Navy was on the news today, is outraged that this man, Walker, and his son have been allowed to plead guilty and plea bargain themselves down to a reduced sentence so he may serve as little as 10 years in prison for everything that he's done to harm this country. And there are other cases which are just as horrendous where people seem to get nothing more than a slap on the wrist. And so we said, well, no wonder there's no deterrence. You know, I think we've all read the statistics that of every 100 crimes committed, what is it, about 60 people will be apprehended. And of those, maybe, I forget how it goes, 40 of those will actually come to trial. And of those, 30 will be convicted. And of those, maybe 10 will be given any kind of a sentence at all. So with a 10% chance of really suffering, why not take the chance? I mean, there's no deterrence in that. This last point, or actually the third point, let's get into this real quick, is imprisonment. Today is the most common form of punishment. That is today the most common penalty. In the Bible, it didn't exist. There was no provision for imprisonment. And if you think about all the horrors that take place in prisons today, you can see what that society was spared. The individual was punished financially, assuming he wasn't killed. He was punished financially or physically, and then he was left in his society to rehabilitate himself. You see, he wasn't put in an artificial environment that just either exposed him to violence or caused him to nurture this tremendous sense of bitterness and allowed him to be schooled in further ways of breaking law. The evils of prisons were avoided. Then, of course, today we also face the problem in terms of rehabilitation. This is the fourth point, rehabilitation. Today, rehabilitation of criminals is very rare. This is one of the things a lot of people are very concerned about. But in the Bible, it was emphasized. The purpose of the punishment was to punish, but also to change the behavior. Which is the way God deals with us too, spiritually. Sometimes God punishes, but he doesn't punish to get some delight in seeing us suffer. He punishes us so that we can be rehabilitated, as Hebrews, the book of Hebrews makes very clear. The criminal in ancient Israel was kept out of prison and in the community, so he was neither corrupted nor dehumanized. How, after a person has been corrupted and dehumanized, do you then rehabilitate him when he leaves? You know, you bring him out worse off than when he went in. And then you wonder why he's not rehabilitated. This doesn't make any sense. Secondarily, today what does a person released from prison get? Besides maybe a new suit of clothes and a bus ticket to the nearest town and, what is it, $25 or $50 maybe if they're generous in his pocket. You know, and he's left on his own resources to somehow find his way in the world. You see, because he already has this stigma. So this is something that it's very hard for our society to do, but by the ancient Israelite approach as given by God of leaving him in the community, he was neither corrupted nor dehumanized. but he was left in his community with his resources to rehabilitate himself. And then society was legislated by God to limit temptations, especially to theft, which is still among the most common crimes. What are some of these things? And you might be able to contribute it because of lack of time, I'll just tell you. Sabbatical year of release allowed people to get out from crushing burdens of debt. The Jubilee, in which land that had been alienated from a family returned, so a family regained its resources. The provision that when gleaning a field, for gleaners, in other words, you didn't reap so that nothing fell to the ground. Whatever fell to the ground as you reaped had to stay there so the gleaners could have it. And you didn't round the corners of your field because you left the corners for the poor. Not lending on usury. Didn't pile up a huge burden of debt. Third tithe, of course. And even the matter of slaves, Hebrew slaves, what were they to be, was to be done with them after they finished their 6 years of labor, presumably during which they learned something of usefulness, that they could now support themselves? What was done? Did they just get shown the door? Well, your 6 years are up as of midnight, so I want you out of my house by midnight. Is that what the slave owner said? No.
They were provided for.
Yeah, they were given a sufficient grub stake so they could start out. They weren't just let go with nothing. And so there were other positive legislation that enabled people who had found it difficult to survive and maybe had turned to criminality to have the means to avoid it in the future. And we have failed in large measure to do anything other than just provide meaningless welfare. Okay, let you go.